The opinions and commentary expressed in the following presentation do not necessarily reflect the views of this station, the Economic Club of Indiana, or the Economic Club's agents or sponsors. Support for the Economic Club of Indiana is provided by the Lumina Foundation, with a goal to increase the percentage of Americans with high-quality degrees and credentials to 60% by the year 2025. Focused on ensuring an accessible, responsive, and accountable higher education system.
Welcome to the Economic Club of Indiana. Today's presentation is from Dr. John C. Goodman, healthcare economist and president of the Goodman Institute for Public Policy Research.
So we are so pleased today to have with us Dr. John Goodman, who's one of the nation's foremost intellectuals on healthcare economics and healthcare services. Dr. Goodman has been described as the father of the health savings account. In his most recent Forbes blog post, Dr. Goodman asked whether high deductibles are a good thing or whether it's better for people to self-insure for whole categories of medical care, such as primary care and complex diagnostic tests. These are important and complex questions. Dr. Goodman is the president of the Goodman Institute for Public Policy and Research. He is the author of more than 50 studies on health policy, retirement reform, and tax issue. He has authored more than 10 books on healthcare policy. He regularly appears on national television, radio, on programs such as CNN, PNS, Fox Business Network, Fox News, and CNBC. Particularly importantly, Congress regularly looks to Dr. Goodman for scholarly advice on healthcare and tax policy, and you'll be hearing more about that in just a few moments. Dr. Goodman received his PhD in economics from Columbia University and has taught at Stanford, Dartmouth, Southern Methodist, and the University of Dallas. Dr. Goodman is often described as a libertarian economist. Some of his recent commentaries are entitled, "Clinton and Sanders Are Both Wrong," and "What Want to Help the Poor Promote Free Markets in Healthcare." Please welcome me in joining one of our nation's leading healthcare economists, Dr. John C. Goodman, who is returning after 22 years to the Economic Club.
Wow. After an introduction like that, it makes you feel like you should run for office. I'm John Goodman. I approve that message. And I just don't believe that I was here 23 years ago. Now, I was in high school 23 years ago. I brought with me a cell phone today because you never know when you're giving a talk. You could always have an emergency call, right? That's a test of your credibility. The real reason I have this cell phone is to make a point. I think there are more cell phones in the United States than there are people. Panhandler out on the street corner over there, he probably has a cell phone, but he probably doesn't have very good access to health care. If something happens to my cell phone in Dallas, Texas, there are a dozen places I can pop into without an appointment, and I can get quick repairs, high quality, low cost repairs. There are even places that will send a repair person to my condo and fix my iPhone in my home. There's a national chain, it's called iHospital. The people who work for it are called iDoctors. But over in the healthcare field, do you know the average wait for an American to see a new doctor is 3 weeks? 3 weeks, just to see a doctor. In Boston, where we're told they had universal coverage even before there was Obamacare, the wait is 2 months. And amazingly, one out of every 10 Americans who enters a hospital emergency room these days leaves without ever seeing a doctor just because they get tired of waiting. And in some places, it's one in five that leaves, and that's what it is in Canada, by the way. So my question to you is, why is the market so kind to my iPhone, so mean to me? And I believe the answer is that this cell phone is produced and repaired in a real market with real prices, where entrepreneurs know if they solve our problems, they can become millionaires. Whereas over in healthcare, we have so suppressed the price, so suppressed the market, year after year, decade after decade, that no one ever sees a real price for anything. No patient, no doctor, no employer, no employee. And we like to think that our healthcare system is very, very different from the Canadian system or the British system, but the truth of the matter is we are about 80% the same. We mainly pay for health care the same way Canadians pay for health care. We pay for it with time and not with money. When a Canadian sees a doctor, it's free. When we see a doctor and we spend a dollar, only 10 cents is coming out of our own pocket on the average. The other 90 cents is paid for by an employer or by an insurance company or by the government. We have completely lost sight of the fact that markets are there to allocate resources. And we bought into the same notion that's prevalent in Canada and Britain and throughout Europe, and that's the notion that people should never have to choose between healthcare and other uses of money. Have you all ever noticed that when you go to see one of the other professionals, a lawyer, an accountant, an engineer, an architect, what do you call that exterior office area? It's a reception area, right? But when you go to see the doctor, what is it called? It's a waiting room, right? So we're waiting is so much on our minds in healthcare that we can't envision how the healthcare system would operate in a different way. What we forgot is that when you suppress prices, when you suppress real market forces, you elevate the importance of non-market forces in determining whether and how we're going to get healthcare. Now, what do I mean by non-market forces? I mean, how long does it take you on the telephone to make an appointment with a doctor? How many days or weeks do you have to wait before you see that doctor? How long does it take you to get from your place of work or your home to the doctor's office and back again? And once you're there, how long do you have to wait before the doctor sees you? Those are all the non-market barriers to care. And there's a lot of evidence that we could talk about, if you like, that those non-market barriers are a greater deterrent to health care than the fee that the doctor charges. And this is not only true for middle-class families, it's also true for the poor. In America today, there are about 50 million people on food stamps. And people on food stamps can go into any supermarket that you and I go into. They say they pay the same price that you and I pay. They go to the checkout counter, and in the old days, they would put down their food stamps, and if they needed cash, they would put that on top of it. And these days, they have an electronic card. But in any event, you never hear it said that low-income people do not have access to supermarkets, right? I mean, the worst can happen is they have to get on a bus and travel a couple of miles. But you never hear it said that there are supermarkets in the United States that are not taking any more food stamp customers. That just doesn't happen. Now, over in healthcare, we have about 65 million people now that are on Medicaid. And what is the biggest problem they all have? Finding a doctor who will see them. I was in Boston not long ago, and I struck up a conversation with a female cab driver who told me she was on MassHealth, and MassHealth is their Medicaid. And I said, well, how's it working for you? And she says, well, I'm having real trouble finding a doctor who will see me. She said, I went down a list of 20 doctors before I found one that would say yes. And I said, well, were you going down the yellow pages? And she said, no, I was going down the list that MassHealth gave me. Now, that's what they call universal coverage in Boston these days. So what do they do? Medicaid patients around the country go to community health centers. They go to safety net hospitals. In my city, it's Parkland Hospital. On Parkland Hospital, unless you're bleeding all over the floor, the wait to see a doctor is probably 4, 5, 6 hours, depending on the day of the week and the hour of the day. Now, while all that's going on, we have 2,000 walk-in clinics around the country today. Some of you may have noticed in the CVS pharmacies here, they're called MinuteClinics. The reason they're called MinuteClinics is because they understand that your time is valuable as well as your money. Studies show that the nurses following computerized protocols in these MinuteClinics follow best practices as good or better than traditional primary care physicians. But here's the problem. In Dallas, Texas, where I live, if you had a sore throat or had an earache, the charge would be about $75. And Medicaid only pays about half that much. And here's the kicker. If the patient tries to take money out of her pocket or her purse and add to what Medicaid pays, the nurse on the other side could actually go to prison. So not only do we outlaw the ability of the Medicaid patient to add to the Medicaid fee, but we criminalize the whole thing. You can go to jail if you try to make medical care available the way we make food available to basically the same population. I believe we could overnight fundamentally expand access to care for low-income populations, do so almost immediately, just by allowing low-income people to have access to health care the same way they have access to food. And so it kind of reminds me of the couple that went to the doctor. And his heart was in really, really bad shape, and his arteries were clogged. And the doctor calls the wife over and he says, you know, your husband is in really, really bad shape. And what you need to do is make sure he does not have any stress. So make him as comfortable as possible. Give him whatever he wants to eat. If he wants to have sex, give him sex. Don't argue with him. Don't fuss at him. Don't nag at him. Well, the couple is driving home, and the man said, well, turns to his wife. And he says, you know, I'm curious. You had a long conversation with the doctor. What did he say? Well, he said, you're going to die. You know, Indianapolis has a very special place in my heart. Yes, I really was around 23 years ago. In fact, about 25 years ago, I was making a number of trips up here to visit with Pat Rooney and his colleagues over at Golden Rule Insurance Company. And we designed for the first time in the whole country a health savings account for the Golden Rule employees. And then about 2 years later, Golden Rule began marketing a health savings account. There was no tax advantage now, but they began marketing around the country and were somewhat successful. And then Pat and I went to Washington and tried to sell Congress on this idea, and we really were alone. I mean, we didn't have help from any other think tank. We got no help from the insurance companies, Chamber of Commerce, NFIB, AMA. They either were against it or they were indifferent. So it was a lonely exercise. But in 1996, we got a pilot program, and then in 2003, we got health savings accounts for the whole country. Today, there are 40 million people who either have an HSA or an HRA, and it's the fastest growing product in the marketplace today. People in your community help make this possible. In addition to Golden Rule, we've gotten support through the years from the Lilly Company, the Lilly Endowment, from the Cook Group, from WellPoint. I want to thank Liberty Fund for their financial support here today. So you all have been part of this, and you can be very proud of what we did, because it really did start right here. And now the rest of the nation owes you a big applause and a big thanks. Now, we want to get out of these problems. Thank you. We want to get out of these problems. We have to free the patient, we have to free the doctor, and we have to free the entrepreneur. Doctors are the only professionals in our society who are not free to repackage and reprice the services they offer to the market. All the other professionals, the lawyers, the accountants, the engineers, the architects, when technology changes or demand changes or knowledge changes or anything changes, they can offer a different package to the market, they can reprice it, and they're free to do that. Doctors are slaves to a third-party payment system. Medicare has 7,500 different ways that it pays doctors, 7,500 tasks, and there's no worse way to pay a professional. Because if you pay a professional that way, there are always going to be certain things that you will leave off your list. You can't think of everything you want a professional to do, and you shouldn't have to. But the government did that, and all the private payers pay the same way that Medicare pays. So when these guys drew up their list, which is a decade or so ago, one of the things they forgot was the telephone. That's strange, because it's been almost 100 years since every other professional in our society discovered this is a very convenient way to communicate with clients, right? But your doctor, I'm going to guess, doesn't communicate with you this way. And we get to the end of the century, and everybody discovers email. I mean, even the corner liquor store was emailing me if they thought they had a bottle of wine that I liked. But my doctor's not emailing me. You know, MinuteClinic emails me. They'll say, you know, it's flu season. Have you had your flu shot? Or it's time for children to go back to school. Have they had their shot? So I get an email every month or so from MinuteClinic, but I never get an email from my doctor. And that's because they forgot to put email on the list. So doctors are slaves to a system that is completely inconsistent with how other professionals are practicing. Other professionals charge by time, or they charge by project. No other professional is paid by task. And as a consequence, I'm reminded of Jeffrey Brenner. I don't know if that's a name that any of you will remember. The word hotspots, is that something you're familiar with? Brenner was this doctor, and he was in Camden, New Jersey, and I'm told that that is one of the poorest places in the whole country. Everybody in Camden is either on Medicaid, or they're on Medicare, or they're uninsured. And so Brenner was a scientist, he was a doctor, and he went down the hospital's list, and he discovered that about 1% of all the people who live in Camden responsible for 30% of the hospital's costs. So he picked out just about the worst case. This was a guy who weighed 600 pounds. He was an alcoholic. He was a drug addict. He spent half the year in the hospital. And the other half of the year, he was abusing himself. So Brenner takes this guy under his arm, and he gets him off alcohol, gets him off drugs. He's going to AA now. Brenner finds out he's a Christian, so he gets him back in church. He gets him on welfare so he can have some financial stability in his life. And before long, this guy wasn't going to the hospital anymore. And his total medical costs started going down, down, down. Now, let me ask you all, let me just add one more thing to that. After this case was so successful, Brenner pulled some other doctors together and he formed a clinic. And he calls, the word hotspots comes from the fact that he told me he can drive down the streets of Camden and point to whole buildings and tell you how much that building is costing Medicare, how much it's costing Medicaid. Because he claimed really high-cost patients tend to live around each other for reasons I don't quite understand. But in any event, Brenner started treating lots of patients in this way, started lowering health care costs a lot in Camden, New Jersey, probably by millions of dollars. So now my question to you is, in return for saving you as taxpayers, millions of dollars of taxpayers who fund Medicare, how much do you think they gave back to Brenner? Very good, zero. And how about Medicaid? How much for the state of Medicaid in New Jersey? How much do you think they gave to Brenner? Zero. And why is that? Because that's another thing that was not on the list of 7,500 things that Medicare pays for. What I mainly just described to you was social work. And social work wasn't on the list. Now, before there was a Barack Obama, I went to the Bush administration, and I said, you guys ought to pay Brenner $1 million. And they looked at me like I was crazy, because this is the way people in Washington think. And they said, well, why should we do that when he's already doing these things and we don't have to pay him anything? So then I patiently explained, well, because if you let Brenner become a millionaire and then you tell every other doctor in the country, you come to us and you show us how you can lower costs and raise quality and we'll pay you a different way. You just tell us how you want to be paid. And that was too radical for them. Of course, they couldn't imagine at that time we were going to get Obamacare. In any event, Brenner really liked my idea. I put it in one of my blogs, making him a millionaire, that is. He can't call me and thank me for it. But today, the Obama administration isn't paying him $1 million. They're trying to force him to be an ACO, an accountable care organization, which means just become another bureaucrat in a bureaucratic system. We want to solve our problems, we have to free the doctors. And finally, we have to free the entrepreneurs. People sometimes ask me, can free markets work in healthcare? And my answer is, yes, free markets work quite well wherever the third-party payers aren't. So show me a market where there's no Medicare, no employer, no Blue Cross, and I'll bet you that's a healthcare market that works pretty well. Now, looking around this room, I'm just going to bet that most of you don't know very much about the market for cosmetic surgery. But just give it a few years, and you'll develop an interest in it. Here's a market where the third-party payers aren't. We pay with our own money. What do you get? You get package prices. You know what you're going to pay in advance, right? And it covers everything. It covers the doctor, nurse, anesthetist facility. And over the last 10 years, there has been a steady, steady downward drop in the real cost of cosmetic surgery, while the real cost of every other kind of surgery has been going up. In this market, there's been a huge increase in demand, like 500-600% increase. We have all kinds of technological change of the type we're told increases costs everywhere else in the healthcare system. Here's a market that actually works. LASIK surgery, same thing. Real cost keeps coming down. We have price competition. We have quality competition. We have package prices. Huge technological innovation. Here's a market that really works. All the innovations that are really meeting consumer needs, we've already talked about the walk-in clinics, and they're the standalone emergency care clinics. Rx.com came in existence not to serve Blue Cross, but to serve you and me, to give us an alternative to our local pharmacy. So there's all kinds of opportunity for entrepreneurship. The next big one, by the way, is going to be medical tourism. Health Cities down in Grand Caymans. I was down there just a week ago. You can get on a plane and go down there. They will give you a package price for almost every kind of surgery. If you get an infection, you get a readmission, they pay, not you. And they pay for the airfare, they pay for a hotel, for a caregiver, and the total price is about one-third of what you would pay here other places in the United States. So this is coming, the market is coming, and what we need to do is create a healthcare reform that allows it to happen. Now with Obamacare, there are lots and lots of problems, but let me just discuss four real quickly. Number one, there's a mandate for you to buy a health insurance plan whose cost is going to grow at twice the rate of growth of your income. Now, Barack Obama didn't create the cost problem, and Congress didn't create the cost problem. It's been going on for 40 years. For 40 years, real per capita health care costs have been rising at twice the rate of growth of our income. But unfortunately, the health reform didn't get us off this track. It locked us into it. You know, you by mandate, you have to stay on that path, and they don't give you an alternative to it. That's clearly an impossible outcome, and we've got to reform that. Number two, a bizarre system of subsidies. If a family of four is 138% of poverty in this state, and they go into Medicaid, they get free insurance, and it's worth about $8,000. If they make $1 more, they're kicked out of Medicaid, and they have to go into the exchange, where they get highly subsidized insurance. Let's say a plan that costs $12,000 and they have to pay less than $1,000 to get it. Let's call that an $11,000 gift. But people who work for this hotel, making $10, $15 an hour, at about the same income level, get no extra help from government. They're required to buy insurance that costs, let's say, $12,000 for a family. And if they don't do it, then they get they're not able to go into the exchange, and next April 15th they get a fine. So we have an $8,000 gift, an $11,000 gift, and a fine. Now, not only is that not fair, but it is going to have severe effects on our economy as employers everywhere, and they're already doing this, reorganize their businesses in response to these subsidies. What we need is an economy in which employers hire people and grow and make decisions based on economic factors, not on the basis of health insurance subsidies. Thank you. And then we have number three, the problem of perverse incentives that the insurers are facing in the health insurance exchanges. Health insurers today have figured out that the healthy buy on price and only sick people look at networks. And so what they're doing is everything they can to get the premium down because they're trying to attract the healthy and they're trying to avoid the sick. So how do you do that? With narrow networks. What a narrow network is they throw a price out that most of the best doctors and the best hospitals decline to accept, and that's their narrow network. And then they have very high deductibles this year, over $6,000 if possible. Next year it'll be $7,000. And this is for families that are making $15 an hour. These families look at policies like this and they don't consider it insurance at all. So we're getting a race to the bottom, and it's going to get worse and worse through time. In Dallas, Texas, where I live, there's not a single plan, including Blue Cross, not a single plan in the health insurance exchange that includes UT Southwestern. Well, UT Southwestern is the best facility in our area. We've got Nobel Prize winners working there. But none of the plans in the exchange allow you to go to UT Southwestern. And an increasingly evident feature of all these plans is if you go out of network, they pay nothing. So you want to go to UT Southwestern, it's all coming out of your own pocket. Number four, we've got perverse incentives on the buyer side of the market. You know, people are a lot smarter than the policymakers give them credit for. And millions of people have figured out that they really don't need to go into the exchange and buy insurance until they're sick. Now, you're supposed to be able to buy only in a 2 or 3 month period, the open season window, but the Obama administration has created so many exceptions that, as a practical matter, you can probably buy insurance any time of the year. All you have to have is an event that qualifies, and that could be a divorce, you lose a job, somebody cuts off your electricity. There's a long list of things that qualify you to buy insurance at any time during the year. So what are people doing? They're waiting until they get sick, and then they're buying their insurance, and they're getting their care, and they're getting the bill paid, and then they drop the insurance. And I don't know how often this is happening, but the insurance companies are all complaining, so it must be happening a lot. And the insurance companies are losing lots and lots of money, so they have every reason to look at this carefully. In Massachusetts, these are called jumpers and dumpers. People jump in when they're sick, and they dump their plan after they get the bills paid. But if we all do that, then the only people who have health insurance will be sick. And if the only people who have health insurance are sick, then the premium is going to be really, really high. And that leads to what we call a death spiral. As the healthy drop out, the cost of the plan just keeps going up until it requires a premium that none of us can afford. Well, what can we do as an alternative for that? For the last year, I've been working with Republicans mainly in Congress on an alternative to this. But it doesn't have to be a Republican alternative. I was over at the AHIP the other day, which is controlled by Democrats these days. I said, look, if I were talking to you guys, I won't call it an alternative to Obamacare. I'll just call it a way to make Obamacare actually work. But we all know there are serious, serious problems here. And it doesn't have to be right. It doesn't have to be left. We need to find common sense answers. And the first common sense answer is we need choice. So we need all of you to be able to choose health insurance that meets your needs and your family's needs and not the needs of the government. And by the government, I mean the special interests who influence the government. Instead of telling us what the package of benefits should be that we have to buy, give us the tax subsidy you want to give us, and then let us make our own choices with additional dollars on what we want and what we don't want. And second, we need fairness. Instead of having radically different subsidies for people at the same income level, we need the same subsidy for everybody. Our bill, the bill I've been working on for a year, is sponsored by Pete Sessions, who's head of the Rules Committee in the House. He's part of the Republican leadership there. And by Bill Cassidy over in the Senate, who is a doctor and is most knowledgeable about health care over on the Senate side. We're just about to come together on this. And the tax credit that we want is about $2,500 for an adult and $8,000 for Family of Four. And everybody would get that regardless of income. Virtually all the problems with the exchanges, the reason they don't work is because they're trying to verify your income. And indeed, in the ideal world, when you go to the exchange, the way it was supposed to work in the beginning is you tell them about yourself and they go to the IRS to determine your income. They go to Social Security to see how many employers you work for. They go to the Labor Department to see what health insurance plan you're in, whether it qualifies. They go to Medicaid to see if you work there. So we've got, in this ideal world, the exchange is communicating with all these different departments of government, computer talking to computer, and there's one big problem with that. Nobody's ever been able to devise a way for one government computer system to talk to another. Now, the Department of Defense and the VA system tried for 10 years to get this done for our military folks, and they spent over $1 billion, and finally they gave up. They said, we just don't know how to do it. Well, we should take that lesson to heart. And if we all get the same subsidy regardless of income, we don't have to verify income. Under our bill, we don't care if you qualify for Medicaid. You don't want to be in Medicaid, you don't have to be in Medicaid. You can have private insurance. So lots and lots of problems. You don't have to guess your income, by the way, and you don't get penalized next April 15th if you didn't guess your income correctly. So all of those problems go away. But here is the most important part of this tax credit, this universal tax credit for us in this election year, where the biggest single issue is middle-income folks and their income not rising, right? Here's what we're going to do for employers. We're going to say to every employer and every union in the country, we're going to give you a choice. If you want to stay where you are, you can stay where you are. But we're going to give you an opportunity to come into the tax credit system. And here's how it works. Suppose you got individual insurance from an employer, and it costs $5,000. Right now, every one of those $5,000 is tax advantage. It's all pre-tax. So we're subsidizing every single dollar, and that's why we've got a problem, because the more dollars you spend on health insurance instead of wages, the lower your taxes. So what we're going to say to the employers, you have the opportunity to push all your tax benefits up front. So instead of being out over here, you can have the first $2,500 dollar for dollar tax credit, and then the next $2,500 is all after tax. Now that may seem kind of complicated and archaic, and why do we want to do all that? Here's why. Because if the last $2,500 is after tax, that means it's on the same footing as take-home pay. And that means if you and your employer decide that some benefits in your plan are marginal and not really worth what you're paying, or if you decide a narrow network would meet your needs, not every doctor in the community, but just some of the best, not every hospital, You know, in Dallas, Texas, Blue Cross told me, Dallas-Fort Worth, must be 50 hospitals. Blue Cross told me that for their employer plans, there's not one single hospital that's not in their network. Not one. And I said, well, why is that? They said, because if we left even one out, for sure the wife of the CEO, that would be the hospital she would want to go to, and we would have all kinds of problems. So that's the way these decisions are made today. But if employers and employees knew that, you know, if they narrow the number of hospitals, they can move thousands of dollars away from the health plan into the family's take-home pay, dollar for dollar, I think that in a very short period of time, the average family would have a $2,000 increase in take-home pay just from this one health care reform. The other reform we need, by the way, is corporate tax reform. And with a corporate flat tax of 9%, we could save the average family another $3,000. So there really are things that politicians could do to raise the income of the average family, but we're not talking about it right now. Well, you all know what we're talking about. And a lot of times it's not very serious. What about the exchange itself, this race to the bottom? We're getting rid of that. We're going to have a real market with real insurance premiums, and it works the way Medicare Advantage works. In the Medicare Advantage program, one-third of seniors, by the way, have who are in Medicare, are in Medicare Advantage plans. These are private plans. The seniors pay community-rated premiums, but then the plan gets an additional premium from the federal government based on the health status of the senior. And so you have some seniors with lots and lots of problems, and you have plans that specialize in special needs for these seniors, and they get $60,000 per enrollee, or even more than that. We're going to use that same adjustment mechanism in our exchange plans. And so if I'm in one plan and I move to another plan, my premium may not change at all, but the new plan gets an additional premium based on my health status. That way we make the sick just as attractive as the healthy to every health plan. And that way we can have plans that specialize in certain kinds of diseases and treatments. Cancer Health Treatment Centers of America that advertises on TV all the time, they might say, look, send us all your cancer patients. We want to treat them all. We're better than you are. We specialize in this, and we want to do this. But they're not going to do it today, because today these plans are dumping their sick people on other plans and not paying for them. In the new world that I'm thinking about, no plan is ever going to be able to dump its sickest patients on some other plan. And finally, we're not going to let individuals game the system. I don't know if you all have ever thought about it, but in the Medicare program, there is no mandate. You ever thought about that? When you become eligible for Medicare, you go into Part B, you go into Part D, you go into Medigap, no mandate, all community rated, guaranteed issue. But if you don't join when you're first eligible to join, you are penalized. And in Part B and Part D, the penalty just keeps going up through time. And in Medigap, you can actually be underwritten, which means when you apply, you can be charged a premium based on your health status. So for our seniors, we figured out a way to make this work without telling everybody what they have to do. And we need to apply that same principle to the underage population. You know, when the Japanese Yakuza, when a member of their organization commits a serious mistake, you know what they do? They sever a finger. And then they offer that finger to their superior by means of atonement. And I've often thought that if people in the Obama administration, people in Capitol Hill, had as much integrity and honesty as the members of the Japanese mafia, well, one thing for sure, we have a lot less finger pointing. Now, I promised I would leave some time for you to ask questions. I told the host here that if I was really good, you might not have any questions. But if I missed some things, I want to give you an opportunity to tell me that. Let me just say in closing, I was introduced as the father of health savings account. Most people think about health savings accounts as a money issue. And it's for sure true that money is involved, because if you're a careful consumer of health care, then you're going to save money, and the money you save, you get to keep. So all that's true. But for me, there's always been something more important, and that is the issue of power. You know, the healthcare system can be an indifferent system. It can be an impersonal system. It can be a system that does not respond to your personal needs. It can sometimes even be a cruel system. And I've always believed that if you maintain control of the money and you maintain the power to make your own decisions, that that system is going to work better for you than transferring that money and power to some impersonal bureaucracy. You've been a good audience. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Dr. Goodman, for those really terrific and insightful comments. And so please fill out cards and bring them to me with your questions for Dr. Goodman, and I know there will be many. And I'll begin with this question, following up on some of your comments. The individual mandate, where everyone is required to purchase insurance, was originally conceived and promoted by conservative think tanks and economists in order to promote individual accountability and to prevent free riders. Can you comment on why the individual mandate has become so divisive?
These people, both conservative and liberal, just did not think this through. And I remember sitting in Bill Thomas's office years ago. Bill Thomas was the chairman of Ways and Means who gave us the health savings account. And he asked me about the mandate. And I said, well, Bill, let me ask you something. Suppose you have a mandate and I don't do what I'm supposed to do. What are you going to do to me? You're going to put me in prison? Are you going to use a cattle prod on me? I mean, what are you going to do to me to punish me for not obeying the mandate? And we finally agreed there wasn't anything he could do for me except fine me. So I said, okay, so what we're really talking about is a financial relationship. You know, if I do what you want, I have more money. If I do what you don't want, I have less money. Well, isn't that the way the system mainly already works? Before there was an Obamacare, if you got insurance from an employer, you got to buy it with pre-tax dollars, so you got a big tax break. And the higher your marginal tax rate, the bigger your tax break. But if you didn't buy health insurance, you paid a penalty. You paid more taxes next April 15th. So we have had, since the end of World War II, a system in which we reward people for buying health insurance and we punish them for not doing it. And if you want to make the penalty even stronger, I don't care if you want to do that, but there's no reason to tell people what insurance they have to buy. That's a mistake. Because once you do that, then all the special interests will come in and they'll say, well, you have to cover naturopathy and you have to cover this and you have to cover that. And what will be in the package will reflect the strength of the lobbyists, not consumer choice. So we do not need a mandate, but we do need the financial incentives for everybody to buy health insurance.
Thank you. Which presidential candidate do you believe has the most effective health care policy?
Well, he's already dropped out. Marco Rubio had the best, and he didn't say a whole lot about it, but he and Paul Ryan endorsed this idea, which basically I gave to Paul Ryan 10 years ago, and that's the idea of the tax credit that we've been talking about here today. And so Ryan has endorsed that idea, so has Marco Rubio, but he's no longer in. The other Republican candidates do not have serious health care plans. And what I mean by that is if your plan is you're going to take health insurance away from 20 million people and you have no other plan to help them, that's, to me, not serious. So a replacement for Obamacare has to be serious, has to provide something for everybody, and it just can't dump people out on the street. And so that's what our universal tax credit would do. It's refundable. Refundable, advanceable, transferable, and it is set at a level that's close to Medicaid, and it will put a floor under what's available for everybody. And then if you want better insurance, you want more options, then you and your employer have to add more after-tax dollars.
Thank you. How do you create a system where people are incentivized to become more healthy?
Well, that's a tough one because we've got a system under which we say to you, you can be as unhealthy as you want to be, and if you have medical bills, essentially someone else is going to pay for it. So I don't object to the employer plans that give employees incentives, and not just employer plans, but also insurance company plans that give people incentives to live a healthier life. But it worries me because there's a fine line between encouraging people to be healthy and developing a plan that says, if you're unhealthy, we don't want you. Because remember what I said about the insurance companies in the exchange? They're trying to attract the healthy and avoid the sick. And by the way, it's even worse after you enroll. After you enroll, their incentive is to overprovide to the healthy with services that only healthy people want, and underprovide to the sick because you didn't want the ones you got and you don't want any more of them. So employers are in the same position. I don't know if any of you have noticed, but every large employer today is also an insurance company. And if they attract a bunch of employees who are sick, or more likely, employees with dependents who are sick, what happens? Their costs go up. So they're reacting the same way the insurance companies are reacting. They're devising plans that look really attractive to healthy prospective employees and don't look attractive to the ones who are sick. So I worry that that the desire for healthiness can be used as an excuse to develop plans which obviously have no point. And just to give you one example, when I was employing a lot of people, I noticed that all the plans that the insurers were offering to me had small co-payments for doctor visits, but huge co-insurance payments for people who went in the hospital. Well, it's the doctor visits that people have choice about and discretion about. Once you get in the hospital, you're not choosing anything. So that obviously had no point other than just to attract the healthy and be unattractive to the sick. So I worry about using healthiness as an excuse to simply run away from sick people.
Thank you. How have HSAs managed to survive and thrive under Obamacare?
Well, the Obama administration has basically left them alone. It's put a few minor restrictions on them, but they basically left them alone. And they're continuing to grow. As I said, I think there are 40 million people now who either have an HSA or an HRA. You would think that they would be popular in the exchange, but almost all the people in the exchange are low-income folks. I don't know if you all realize this. The people who are entering the exchanges are mainly people who are within 250% of poverty, and they're the ones that are getting the huge subsidies. But they're also the ones who are facing huge deductibles. In some cases, they can be as high as $6,000. And they don't have $6,000. And even if they are HSA compatible, it doesn't matter because they don't have any money to put into a health savings account. And the insurance companies aren't putting any money there. So there you have high deductibles, which are serving no purpose other than to discourage people from getting health care. And people do not have the accounts. But outside the exchanges, in the employer market, it's the fastest growing part of the market.
Thank you. I have several questions along this vein, which is, do you believe that there are good parts of Obamacare?
Oh, of course. We insured 20 million people. That's got to be good. Obama actually... this was the first reform that adopted the tax credit approach. What I like about the tax credit is that your tax benefits are limited. And once you get past the credit, all the dollars you spend are after tax. And so that encourages us as consumers to make sure that when we spend a dollar on health insurance, we're getting a dollar's worth of value. Unfortunately, the tax credit is phased out really quickly, so you get really high marginal tax rates. As I explained earlier, we're totally inconsistent. We're giving different benefits to people at the same income level, thousands of dollars of difference. So the two most important things are a way to insure the uninsured and tax credit. And I would just say, let's build on that. So let's don't take insurance away from 20 million people. Let's instead build on that and create a system under which we treat everybody in the country the same way, get rid of all the perverse incentives. And one way you can think about the set of reforms that I've been outlining for you today is it gets rid of all the perverse incentives under Obamacare.
Thank you. Which states are doing the best job?
Well, the problem with the states is that they have very little discretion. There's very little, very few things states can do on health. It's so dominated by federal policy. But this state has probably done better than any state on Medicaid, and I'm not an expert on it, but I've been really impressed with what you did first under Mitch Daniels, and then Mike Pence continued it. And you're creating accounts for the Medicaid enrollees, at least for the expansion population. You have high deductibles, by high I mean $2,500, but you put $2,500 in an account for the enrollee. And I think it's worked very well, am I right? Okay, so it's working better than Medicaid in any other state that I know of. What we're going to do under our bill is we're going to block grant the whole Medicaid program back to the states and give you total control. And then a state like Indiana is going to lead the way, and you're going to do all kinds of things that other states will hopefully follow.
And our final question says, I am a 92-year-old who lives in France. Welcome to Indiana, whoever wrote this question. I recently fell. They took me to the emergency room where I was treated immediately. I was charged 10 euros. The doctor followed up by making a house call. Why don't we have a system like this in the U.S., and why do we mainly talk about choices?
Well, I want a health insurance system under which people make their own choices, where individual choice is appropriate and possible. Wherever it's appropriate, wherever it's possible, nobody is in a better position to make those decisions than you. And so if you have a mother, for example, in the middle of the night, has a sick child, does she want to take the child to the hospital emergency room? You know, the average charge there is $500. Does she want to call Uber medical house calls, which exists in San Francisco and some other cities? That would be a charge of about $100. Or does she want to treat it there in the home? Well, can you make a better decision than she can? Can I? No. She's the best person to make the decision. But where patients don't have the ability to make decisions, where it's not appropriate for them to make a decision even if they could, which is when they go unconscious to the emergency room or with a broken bone or when they're admitted to the hospital, that's where third-party insurers need to play a larger role. So I think an ideal insurance system empowers us, allows us to make our own decisions, especially wherever that's appropriate, but still has a role for the third-party payer when things are basically out of our control. I'm told that I'm going to sign some books out here in just a minute, which I will, and I want you to know if you all want to receive stuff from me about healthcare, just give me a business card and I'll put you on my mailing list, and I'll just send you updates if you would like. You've been a very good audience, but thank you very much.
You've been listening to a speech from Dr. John C. Goodman, part of the 2015-2016 Economic Club of Indiana Speaker Series. Join us next month at this time for a speech from Val Ackerman, Commissioner of the Big East and former U.S. Representative to the International Basketball Federation. The Economic Club of Indiana is a production of WFYI Public Media in Indianapolis for Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations.